The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
So welcome everyone. Tonight I'd like to talk about some of the Buddha's various approaches to working with difficult thoughts or difficult emotions, and I really want to emphasize the variousness of the Buddha's approaches. But I'm going to begin with a poem that I'll read twice by Billy Collins called Shoveling Snow with Buddha. In the usual iconography of the temple or the local walk, you would never see him doing such a thing, tossing the dry snow over the mountain of his bare, round shoulder, his hair tied in a knot, a model of concentration. Sitting is more his speed, if that is the word for what he does or does not do. Even the season is wrong for him. In all his manifestations, is it not warm and slightly humid? Is this not implied by his serene expression and the smile so wide it wraps itself around the waist of the universe? But here we are, working our way down the driveway, one shovelful at a time. We toss the powder into the clear air, we feel the cold mist on our faces, and with every heave we disappear and become lost to each other in these sudden clouds of our own making, these fountain bursts of snow. This is so much better than a sermon in church, I say out loud, but Buddha keeps on shoveling. This is the true religion, the religion of snow and sunlight and winter geese barking in the sky, I say, but he is too busy to hear me. He has thrown himself into shoveling snow as if it were the purpose of existence, as if the sign of a perfect life were a clear driveway you could back the car down easily and drive off into the vanities of the world with a broken heater fan and a song on the radio. All morning long, we work side by side, me with my commentary, and he inside the generous pocket of his silence, until the hour is nearly noon, and the snow is piled high all around us. Then I hear him speak. After this, he asks, "Can we go inside and play cards?" "Certainly," I reply, "and I will heat some milk and bring cups of hot chocolate to the table while you shuffle the deck and our boots stand dripping by the door." "Ah," says the Buddha, lifting his eyes and leaning for a moment on his shovel before he drives the thin blade again deep into the glittering white snow. And for those of you who know Billy Collins, this is a very typical Billy Collins kind of snarky, slightly snarky poem. There's a reason for reading. So, Shoveling Snow with Buddha. In the usual iconography of the temple or the local walk, you would never see him doing such a thing, tossing the dry snow over the mountain of his bare, round shoulder, his hair tied in a knot, a model of concentration. Sitting is more his speed, if that is the word for what he does or does not do. Even the season is wrong for him. In all his manifestations, is it not warm and slightly humid? Is this not implied by his serene expression, that smile so wide it wraps itself around the waist of the universe? But here we are, working our way down the driveway, one shovelful at a time. We toss the light powder into the clear air. We feel the cold mist on our faces, and with every heave, we disappear and become lost to each other in these sudden clouds of our own making, these fountain bursts of snow. This is so much better than a sermon in a church, I say out loud, but Buddha keeps on shoveling. This is the true religion, the religion of snow and sunlight and winter geese barking in the sky, I say. But he is too busy to hear me. He has thrown himself into shoveling snow as if it were the purpose of existence, as if the sign of a perfect life were a clear driveway you could back the car down easily and drive off into the vanities of the world with a broken heater fan and a song on the radio. All morning long, we worked side by side, me with my commentary, and he inside the generous pocket of his silence. Until the hour is nearly noon and the snow is piled high all around us, then I hear him speak. After this, he says, "Can we go inside and play cards?" "Certainly," I reply, "and I will heat some milk and bring cups of hot chocolate to the table while you shuffle the deck and our boots stand dripping by the door." "Ah," says the Buddha, lifting his eyes and leaning for a moment on his shovel before he drives the thin blade again deep into the glittering white snow. And I offer this poem tonight because it invites us to imagine in a kind of humorous way how the Buddha's teachings manifest in different contexts. So shoveling snow quietly, mindfully, entirely absorbed in shoveling snow while this nattering, dare I say idiot, kind of just jabbers on next to him. And I sort of think about this idea that the Buddha says, you know, do you want to go inside and play cards as a kind of act of kindness? Because then suddenly this person can, you know, make the cups of cocoa and do all these other things. So the Buddha is just kind of doing a very his own thing very, very quietly, shoveling snow. And some teachers, and I'm particularly thinking of the work of Stephen Batchelor, have really drawn attention to the Buddha's pedagogical skills. That is, his ability to adapt his teaching methods to the life circumstances and level of understanding of the person that he was instructing. And this, I think, is the mark of a really good teacher. I once heard Gina Sharp, who was the guiding teacher for New York Insight, say that the job of the teacher is to be in service to the student, to let go of any agenda, and to figure out what will really help the student. And in looking at the teachings of the Buddha in the discourses, I think it's really helpful to have some idea of the audiences that he was addressing the various discourses to. And I want to talk about this by first giving an example from another religious tradition to explain why. So when Jesus offered the parable of the Good Samaritan, you know, which is a story about a man who is set upon by robbers and left by the side of the road, injured and bleeding. And Jesus tells a story, and the Pharisees, which were, you know, a sect of Judaism came by, a Pharisee came by and ignored him, another Jew came by and ignored him, but a Samaritan, who was not a Jew, came by, saw this bleeding man, and assisted him, took him into town, and made sure that he was taken care of. So when Jesus tells this story, it is a story told by a Jew to other Jews saying, what's going on here? You know, that the message is clear. The Samaritan had the humanity and the decency to help this injured man. And the high-ranking Jews and other Jews just ignored him. And so the issue was, you know, asking his community to reflect on their attention to the law and attention to piety and ignoring the reality of suffering. So it's a really clear message as Jesus, a Jew, speaking to other Jews. But when this story of Jesus and the parable of the Good Samaritan is recounted by Christians in the fiercely anti-Semitic late Middle Ages, it becomes a very different story. It's not a Jew speaking to Jews. It's the founder of Christianity giving a teaching which shows the sort of incredible moral deficiencies of Jewish people. It reinforces anti-Semitism. And when I first sort of learned about this as a teaching method when I was in college, it just really struck me how important it is often to know who is the audience for a particular teaching. And so when we look at the Buddha's teaching, it's often really helpful to understand who it was that he addressed the teachings to as a really skillful teacher. And there's a very, sometimes he offered the teachings, say, to a group of people, lay people. And it's always interesting because if you go into the suttas, it'll be at one time and Jetta's Grove, the Buddha said to. So you almost always get a context in the discourses about who the Buddha was speaking to, where and when. So one time, this is a very famous discourse, the Buddha was offering teachings to the Kalmas, the Kalamas. And they were a clan, and as far as I can tell, they were living in the very northern part of the Gangetic Plain, because the story is that when the Buddha was making a visit to his hometown, that then he went and he visited with the Kalamas. And the interesting story is, and when the Buddha's, it's also useful to know that in the Buddha's own time, it was a time of tremendous ferment, tremendous political ferment, when these sort of feudal states were being absorbed into larger and larger political states, into kingdoms. It was a very contentious time politically, a time of gathering more power. It was also a time of tremendous philosophical and religious ferment, when the priests were being challenged in the Brahmanic tradition, and the Jain religion had been established, and there were all sorts of seekers and all sorts of persons really trying to figure out the meaning of life, the meaning of suffering, the way to live. So the Buddha was not the only person who was really investigating what it meant to live a good life, how to really understand suffering and the causes of suffering. So apparently the Kalamas had been visited by a number of people who were proselytizing for their belief system. And they heard that the Buddha was around and invited him to come. And they told him how perplexed they were. And they asked him, you know, what they should believe, given that they'd been told all these different kinds of things. And this is Bhikkhu Bodhi's slightly condensed account of that the Buddha said, "Come, Kalamas, do not go upon what has been acquired by repeated hearing, nor upon tradition, nor upon rumor, nor upon scripture, nor upon surmise, nor upon axiom, nor upon specious reasoning, nor upon bias toward a notion pondered over, nor upon another's seeming ability, nor upon the consideration, this monk is our teacher. When you yourselves know these things are bad, blamable, censured by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to harm and ill, abandon them. When you yourselves know these things are good, blameless, praised by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to benefit and happiness. Enter on and abide in them." And this is a really famous passage, much beloved, because it really is this idea of don't take anything just on the authority of tradition or the reputation of the person who is offering them. Really see for yourself, and what you are to see for yourself in this, does following this teaching lead to harm? Does following this teaching lead to suffering? And, you know, is it something that feeds our greed, feeds our hatred? Does it encourage enmity? But instead, we should look for those teachings that are conducive to our happiness, in that they are good, blameless, they lead to harmonious living. And then he talks about abiding in them. And sometimes here we do that four quarters chant where we talk about, you know, abiding in one direction and all around. And that actually is something that the Buddha offered the Kalamas, that, you know, we can abide in loving kindness. We can abide in compassion. We can abide in appreciative joy. And we can abide in equanimity. So in this teaching to them, what he offered was something that was very practical, that they could look to through their own experience. He didn't talk to them about the Four Noble Truths. He didn't lay out the Eightfold Path. He said, practice with this. See if this makes sense to you. So it's a very appropriate teaching for a large group of people who were sort of swayed back and forth by various visionaries and teachers who were coming to them. And he said, you know, don't do it on the authority of anyone. You know, don't do it on his authority. See if the teachings, you know, lead to what is good, what is blameless. So it's a really beautiful teaching. And he invites them to, you know, practice loving kindness. And at the end of this, he says, you know, he said, if you believe in rebirth, living in this sort of way would lead to a pleasant rebirth. But if you don't believe in rebirth, this sort of life will make your life a pleasant life. So he doesn't add the sort of metaphysical a doctrine to it. He said, no, if there is an afterlife or a rebirth, if you live a good life, you will be born in a pleasant realm. But even if you don't believe in rebirth and there is no rebirth, if you live a blameless life, it will be a better life. It will be a life worth living. So that's that to me has always been an interesting teaching, that he's not dogmatic. In this instance, he's very empirical. He's very pragmatic. Most of the discourses in most of the scriptures, however, are offered to the monastics. And it was mostly monks. The nuns were invited to hear the discourses, but they sat in the back and the monks sat in the front. And the bhikkhus, the practitioners, the monks, were men who had abandoned the householder life. And what is characteristic of the many followers of the Buddha is that they came from many different walks of life. And the caste system in India at that time was not nearly as rigid as it had come to be. But there was the warrior caste, you know, the merchant caste, the priestly caste, the farmer caste, tradesmen. So what you have in the monastery are men who come from very different backgrounds, very different ages, very different educations. So a lot of the rules in the monastery were all about harmonious living. And there's something like 277 rules. And they're rules about how you should urinate, how you should clean up after yourself, how big your robes can be, how many robes you can have. And they were all made to help these guys, and there were numbers of monastic communities, live in harmony. So, and in most of the, in the Vinaya, which is the book of the rules, they always tell you sort of what occasioned the rules, what happened, and so then this rule was made so that everybody could live in harmony. So you have just this, the Buddha's teaching is often a teaching to a group of men, many of them young, many of them dealing with their sexual energies and struggling to live in harmony. And I just want to say as a sort of parenthetical remark here, one of the requisites of monastic life, one of the things that monastics were allowed to have is medicine. That was seen as, and there are some rules about what kind of medicine and how long you can keep them. Like there were tonics that you were only supposed to keep for a week, use for a week, and then you're kind of done with it. But I think it's really important sometimes in meditation communities that sometimes people who are taking medications, whether it's for blood pressure or depression or anxiety, often feel that if they only, you know, got their meditation practice together, they wouldn't need these kinds of medications. And I just think it's really important to underscore that the Buddha was all about skillful means and encouraged the monks to take the sort of medications that were going to be helpful to them. And again, the sort of pragmatism here. So, it's really important to take care of ourselves in that sort of way. And some people feel a little shame or humiliation that, you know, just sitting doesn't bring their high blood pressure down, or just sitting doesn't cure their depression. And that's kind of a misunderstanding of the practice. So Mark has been talking about the discourse on disquieting thoughts, which was a teaching that was given to the monks. And there are sort of five strategies as he talks to the monks about getting rid of disquieting thoughts. And he says, you know, just as you have kind of a rotten peg in a joint, and you get rid of that peg by knocking it out with a peg that is fresh and whole. So we just, you know, sort of knock out the unwholesome thought. And again, you know, we can imagine this is a bunch of guys living together with the sort of struggles of living in a community, a lot of difference coming there, and also the issue of sexuality was a huge issue about, you know, sexual fantasies. So the Buddha is offering these sort of thoughts about disquieting, distracting thoughts. So the first is the pig. And then the second one, he said, you can regard these thoughts as if they were rotten flesh and you wore it in a garland around your neck, and think about how humiliating it would be to walk around with this garland of flesh around your neck, and how you would be embarrassed for people to see you like that. So you can use that thought, and you say, oh, these thoughts are just like this sort of garland of flesh. The third strategy that the Buddha has is to just turn away. You just abandon. You just turn away completely. The fourth is, you just distract yourself with something else. You turn away, you distract yourself with something else. The fourth is called stilling the thought formation. And in that, the Buddha suggests that you just kind of trace back and back and back. He said, it's as if a man is running. And the man says, why am I running? I could be walking. And then the man says, well, if I'm walking, I could just be standing. And if I'm standing, I could be sitting. And if I'm sitting, I could be lying down. And so the Buddha said, you can just trace yourself back and back and back in your thought formations to get rid of this, these distracting thoughts. But if that doesn't work, the final strategy is, the Buddha says, you crush mind with mind. You know, you grit your teeth, you put your tongue on the top of your mouth, and you just crush mind with mind to get rid of this unwholesome thought. And the monastic, the bhikkhu who does this, he says, is, the phrase is, he is a master of the courses of thought. Now, I think that this is a very helpful teaching sometimes, but sometimes just a really peculiar teaching that, you know, the idea of, you know, you just crush mind with mind, that's not something that works for a person of my temperament, actually. And I think, it, you know, that these teachings, which are very, I think sometimes that, you know, this is kind of boot camp dharma, in a way. This is a kind of teaching that really is specific to the sort of struggles that were going on in this community, with a lot of distracting thoughts, thoughts that were extremely unkind about each other. And actually, in the sutta, there are stories where sometimes the disputes in a monastery were so irresolvable, in a way, that the Buddha just left. The Buddha just went into the woods, that when he tried to solve these conflicts that the monks were having, and they said, oh, no, no, venerable sir, we can take care of this ourselves. And they were just at it. And so the I think this idea that, you know, you can master your thoughts in this sort of way, that this is an interesting teaching and sometimes an appropriate teaching, but not always, to say that the best way to deal with distracting thoughts or thoughts about, say, depression, is to crush mind with mind. That to me is probably not appropriate in lots of circumstances. It may have been a great way to encourage the monks to practice, but it's not always useful for people who are struggling with depression or with other kinds of difficulties. And actually, the Buddha took a very different approach to people who were struggling with loss or trauma. And I think this is, again, really interesting to look at the specific stories where the Buddha works with someone. So there's the very famous story of Kisa Gotami, and she was a woman who had married into a family where she was very badly treated by her in-laws. And it wasn't until she had a son that the family respected her at all. And she had this young son, and she just adored this child. And everyone loved the child. And the child got sick and died. And her whole world collapsed. And she wouldn't let go of the child's body. And she went around to everyone asking what could be done, who could revive her child. And someone said, you should go talk to the Buddha. And she goes to the Buddha and she says, can you help me? And he said, I will help you, but I need you to do something first. I need you to get me some mustard seed from a home that has been untouched by death, by a household. And so Kisuke Gotami, carrying her dead infant, goes all around the community. And in every door, every household, she asks for mustard seed. And then so we've got it. And she said, and, you know, has there been any death in this family? And every family had been touched by death and by loss. And by the end of the day, she comes back to the Buddha with a deepened understanding of impermanence, of grief. But I think the really important thing about this that she learns is that she's in a community where there is loss, a community where other people are also mourning the deaths of the beloveds, so that she's not alone. She comes to understand that she's not alone in her grief and in her loss. And she comes back to the Buddha, and she relinquishes her child to the cremation ground, and she joins his community. So the teaching here is this teaching of really compassionately helping Kisuke Gotami manage her grief in a way by really understanding. And it's not this sort of intellectual stand, oh, death touches everyone, but to realize how death profoundly affects families, that every family is touched by grief. And this is actually one of the, for some of you who have maybe followed the teacher Pema Chodron, the wonderful American who's the first abbess of a Tibetan monastery in Newfoundland. One of Pema Chodron's teachings, whenever we encounter tremendous suffering in our lives, one of the moves she always encourages people is to say, other people feel this pain. To really understand, and it's not in any way to diminish your own pain and your own suffering. It's a teaching about, oh, there are other people understand this. Other people feel this pain. Other people know this grief. And that's one way in which we can skillfully work with loss and grief. The wonderful teacher, Lou Redman, after spending months in a coma, said his great understanding after his just a year of just complete incapacitation, said, everything is connected. Nothing lasts. You are not alone. And that's kind of the teaching that Kisuke Gotami got. The other story that I think is so moving and beautiful about the Buddha working with trauma, and, you know, trauma and grief, those are all really disquieting thoughts. The mind is just a wreck. There's the story of Patakara, who was a woman who lived in a somewhat affluent family. And she fell in love with a servant in the family. That her parents had other ideas about who she should marry. But she ran off with the servant that she loved, and they lived a distance away from her family. And when it came time for her to have her first child, she wanted to return home, because that's the custom in India, to have your child at home. But her husband was really hesitant to have her do that because of her parents' disapproval of their marriage. And so she had her first child. And then when she became pregnant with her second child, she really wanted to go and have that child with at her parents' house. And so she took the toddler, the first child, and the second one. She said to her husband, if you're not going to come with me, I'm going to go by myself. And she left, and he came after her. And and they were heading toward her parents, and there was a terrible storm coming. And so the husband helped Potiphar and the little toddler find a place by the roots of a tree where they would be somewhat sheltered. And he went off to get some more branches and get some more coverings for them to survive this terrible storm. But as he's doing that, he's bitten by a snake and he dies. And she spends the night in the storm. She gives birth during the storm, and she is afraid that her husband has abandoned her. But instead, in the next morning, she finds that he's dead. He died of the snake bite. So she travels on to try to get to her parents' house with this newborn and her toddler. And she comes to a river that was usually pretty fordable, but because of this terrible, terrible storm the night before, the river is very full. And so she has the toddler wait on one side of the river, and she goes across with the infant, and she puts the infant down on the other side of the river, and she comes back, and halfway across the river, she hears this noise, and she turns around, and she sees a bird of prey come down and pick up the infant and fly off. And she starts screaming. And the toddler on the other side, you know, she's halfway in the river, thinks that he's being called, and he rushes into the river, and he's just swept away. So she loses both children. And just staggered by this loss, she heads toward her parents' house, goes across the river, heads toward her parents' house, and discovers that the storm actually collapsed their house. Her parents are killed and her brother is killed. Just this complete tragedy of her entire family being wiped out. And she loses her mind. She becomes feral. And she lives like an animal, getting food that are scraps. She's unapproachable. She's just wild and naked and just living this just terrible life. And the Buddha, in his travels, comes to the community where she is. And everyone's afraid of her because she's just so wild. And he sees her in the distance, and his companions, you know, say, ignore her, leave her alone, let's go the other way. But instead, the Buddha approaches her. The Buddha goes toward her, and he's got this tremendous compassion, tremendous kindness. And he's not afraid of her. He sees her for who she is, and he's not afraid of her. And he says to her, "Sister, please regain your presence of mind." And in his gesture of compassion, in his approach to her, in his seeing her as a human being and not an animal, she's able to come to her senses in a way, and to respond to him. I mean, she's had just this unbelievable trauma, but he sees her for who she is. He recognizes her sorrow, and he just approaches her with this tremendous kindness. And she's able to, live like a human being, and she also becomes part of the community, and she's taken care of there. So it seems to me that it's really important that that we recognize a repertoire of approaches to dealing with difficult thoughts, of approaching trauma of, it seems to me that what the Buddha often does with people who are really suffering is he leads with compassion. And so in these cases, like Padakara and Kisagotami, it's this the humanity of the Buddha comes forth. And he leads with loving kindness, with metta, with compassion. And sometimes practitioners who experience depression, or who have, for example, been affected by the trauma of systemic racism, discover that they can't stay with the breath, that much less crush mind with mind, that often when we come to practice and we have a lot of suffering, sometimes what's really skillful is to abide in loving kindness, to do the Buddha's response to trauma was to offer kindness and refuge, safety and community. Not a practice. What he offered was safety and community, and invited people to abide in loving kindness. He says in the end of the Metta Sutta, this is said to be the sublime abiding, like abiding in loving kindness, by not holding to fixed views, having clarity of vision, being freed from sense desires, one is not born again into suffering. So it's really this abiding in loving kindness, abiding in compassion. The Buddha said that his purpose was to teach suffering and the end of suffering. And I think his teaching should always be understood in that light, that he was sensitive to all kinds of suffering and the cause and conditions of all kinds of suffering. And like a wise doctor, the Buddha offered the appropriate remedy and the appropriate teaching to help the patient become healthy. So in the case of the bhikkhus, it's giving them this teaching that lets them become, the master of the courses of thought, to give them these different sorts of strategies for dealing with disquieting thoughts, the peg, the garland of flesh, working with distraction, crushing mind with mind. That was what was really appropriate in that circumstance for those persons. In other cases, the Buddha alleviates suffering and the causes of suffering in a really different way. But in all the ways, what he's offering is community. A community in which we can together give support to each other, get support from each other, and really come to understand suffering and the causes of suffering. So those are my reflections for the evening, and I appreciate your kind attention. And I apologize if I've said things that might have offended someone. That was not my intention, but if that's the impact, I apologize truly. And I would be interested in any remarks you might have, any considerations of this, any questions. And we do have a mic.
Dealing with deep loss, you talked about Pema Chodron encouraging us to recognize that other people are feeling what we're feeling too. And she does take that further, a practice where you not only just acknowledge that these other people are there, but in some way visualize breathing in all of their suffering, and just letting that crush your self-cherishing thoughts. And then, breathing out, light or peace or metta or whatever image that you use. And the idea is that what that, you know, it just seems totally unnatural and something you might not want to do, counterintuitive, but the benefit is it ventilates the self-centered thoughts, the self-cherishing thoughts, is what, which is what really makes you suffer.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, thank you.
Thanks. Thank you, Kermit. Yeah, that's the Tonglen practice, which is done more in Tibetan communities, of really breathing in the suffering of others, of being willing just to take that all in.
Yeah, and then it's done with the wish, too, that you take it all upon yourself and feel it yourself, with the wish that then they don't have to feel it. That's part of big part of that, too. So, anyway.
And, you know, again, as we want to do this with as much kindliness as possible, you know, if that seems feasible for you to do, that these practices are practices that you know, you can experiment with and see if you're ready to do that kind of a practice. And sometimes when people are just so raw and bereft, that's not a practice that's really accessible right now, of taking in others' suffering. It may be that you stay at, you know, just realizing that other people share this pain. Who else would like to comment on this?
Yeah, so I guess just to carry on with the some of the teachings that Kermit had mentioned, I listen and read from Pema Chodron teachings quite a bit and have kind of put some of that into practice. And another thing that she talks about with suffering more on a personal level, like you were mentioning, how like sometimes our own suffering is so great that it's maybe not wise to be reflecting on all the other suffering in the world, but instead just developing kind of that interest in the suffering, and also seeing it as a opportunity to learn something, and that actually it has some value in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it really does it really does, in a funny way, have a really kind of relieving effect. You know, it, because it removes a little bit of the judgment when you bring in the interest. And of course, it's a practice because we have so much habit around avoiding and trying to label and describe it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that pure interest can be such a powerful tool for just kind of managing unavoidable suffering that comes in life from loss and disappointment. So, yeah.
Thank you. That's a great idea. And this idea about skillful means. So interest sometimes can be really skillful means. You know, even in our mindfulness practice, that often, you know, the mind is just kind of going all over the place. Can we get interested in that? Can we get interested? And that's a great encouragement. Can we be interested? It's always a question. Instead of can we judge it, can we, you know, want to get rid of it, can we be interested in it with this just kindly curiosity?
I have a question about the Buddha being in places where people weren't getting along and working things out, and he would leave.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, wow, that's amazing. I would like to hear more about that. Like people were still behaving like dualistic, fighting people. And then he just,
one of the things that I have really appreciated is learning more and more about sort of the scholarship of the Buddha's lifetime and many of the difficulties that he faced. And late in his life, his cousin Devadatta led a contingent that wanted to usurp his leadership. And they said that there should be more rules and they should be harsher, that everybody should be a vegetarian, that everybody should sleep in really raggedy clothes, raggedy robes, and no one should sleep under a shelter. Everyone should sleep out in the open. And the Buddha said, you know, if you want to do that, that's okay with me, but we don't all have to do that. And there were some monks who left. They left and they followed Devadatta to be in this sort of more austere, more rigorous kind of practice. So there are numerous instances where people didn't get along. And there are also, I mean, there's one where they say, you know, how is it that you guys get along so well and so many of the others don't? And they say, you know, oh, I just am always, cognizant of, the wishes of my venerable brothers. Why should my wishes take precedence? There were some people who lived really harmoniously and others didn't. And there is actually a wonderful novel about this sort of dissension in the monastery at the time of the Buddha called The Kosambi Intrigue, written by a wonderful Buddhist practitioner, Susan Carroll Stone, and it's endorsed by many of the teachers. Say this is just Lee Brazington and Stephen Batchelor. Say this is a great book, and you can get it from Amazon. The Kosambi Intrigue, if you'd like to read a sort of novelistic account, but you know, and it makes sense. It makes sense because here are all these people who are seeking something, leaving their homes, coming together, and they're all from different backgrounds. Of course there's going to be contention, and especially as, you know, large numbers of people live together. So it was, the Buddha was really a pragmatist, and that's why there are just all these different rules in the Vinaya that were just trying to solve a problem. And it humanizes the Buddha in so many ways to realize that, you know, here was a person, a great spiritual teacher, who also had to deal with these kinds of administrative and organizational issues, and in especially toward the end of his life, really difficult political issues, because the two kings that he had been most closely associated with, that he had been an advisor to, both of them were essentially the victims of parricide by their sons. They were killed by their sons. So then the Buddha and his community were living in, with these kings who had killed their fathers, who were the friends of the Buddha, and he was really concerned for the welfare of the community. And if anyone wants a really lovely short biography of the Buddha, Karen Armstrong, who's not a Buddhist but a religious scholar, wrote a small biography of Buddha that is very, very interesting. But I find it that these teachings really come alive for me when I think of them being offered to specific people at specific times and specific circumstances. And the Buddha, as this great teacher, is like a doctor, you know, figuring out, okay, so what's the appropriate thing? So for some people, it's just, you know, try harder, more effort. And for others, it's just kindliness. Or it's, well, why don't you see for yourself? Why don't you look and see what brings you joy? In one of the teachings with the kings, someone said, you know, to whom should I give dana, right, generosity? To whom should I give? And jumping ahead, I imagine that the Buddha was going to say, well, you know, it's a really good thing to support the monks and the nuns. And instead, the Buddha says, give to whom it would make you happy to give. Give where there's some joy. I mean, that's the teaching, that you learn to be generous by learning the joys of generosity, practicing generosity. So they're just you know, wonderful, wonderful teachings. And I just find that some of this comes really alive and out of context. You know, mind crushes mind. Just sounds like really harsh and probably not appropriate for a lot of people. So I really encourage you to explore some of these teachings and the contexts of these teachings.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.